you've been presenting a paper that shows that the U.S. is violating international labor laws. Uh-huh. What did you find?
So the focus of my research was trying to look at the way that the U.S. was performing or acting in accordance to international labor standards that it promotes in its own trade laws, both in bilateral trade agreements such as the U.S.-Jordan Free Trade Act or unilateral trade agreements such as the U.S. Generalized System of Preferences. And these sort of treaties will make trade access to the United States markets conditional on whether or not states are following international labor standards that they've designated as important. And one of these key standards is forced labor. So I've been thinking a lot lately about the U.S. and sort of using its economic hegemonic power within the global system to push certain human rights standards, but then thinking about that in the context of what it also does at home domestically. And, you know, the United States has gotten rid of slavery since the 13th Amendment after the Civil War, but it also sort of has this problem of having the most incarcerated population in the world, both by percentage and absolute numbers. I mean, it surpasses even China, which has often looked towards China as being like a very bad country in human rights in general, but in forced labor specifically. And so I had a friend who studies the prison system in the U.S. who had briefly mentioned that she thought it'd be really interesting to look at the way that the U.S. doesn't follow international labor laws regarding forced labor when it comes to its use of prison labor, particularly since prison labor has been a focus of various negotiations with China, and also prison labor use has been increased with the increase of incarcerated population in the United States. So the two of us were going to co-write this paper together, but she ended up being unable to do the project. And I found that the U.S. doesn't ratify or sign on to very many international laws because it's very reluctant to do so for national sovereignty or other political reasons. But it has signed on to a number of international conventions and treaties regarding forced labor. They include the ILO Convention 29, the UN Charter, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Helsinki Accords, the UN International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and the American Convention on Human Rights. Some of them they ratified, some of them they're only signatories to, but it has ratified the ILO's Convention number 29, which is the, I believe that the convention is called the Convention concerning the Abolition of Forced Labor. It hasn't signed Convention 29, it's signed Convention 105, which is a convention about the abolishing of forced labor. And even though the U.S. hasn't signed Convention 29, Convention 105 specifically refers to Convention 29 as to what practices fall under forced labor and which practices do not. So the definition that Convention 29 provides about what aspects of prison labor do and do not fall under forced labor is very specific. So first of all, in order for prison labor not to be considered forced labor, it has to be, you know, labor that's done after a conviction in a court of law. It has to be done under a public authority. And it has to be done only for public purposes and not for private interests. And therefore, the U.S. violates, you know, this international convention to which it has ascribed to, because prisoners in state prisons in the United States are being used by private companies through something called the Prison Industries Enhancement and Certification Act, which was passed in 1979. And the second way that the U.S. is in violation is because the U.S. has privately run prison facilities in which productive labor takes place. And that means that this labor isn't being overseen by public authorities. But in fact, the people who run these private facilities have this sort of quasi-judicial or de facto legislative power over the punishment of people who have been convicted of crimes.
So both private and publicly run prisoners are doing work for both the state and private companies. And where are those products going? Are they being traded overseas?
Well, a number of the products are being traded overseas. I don't have exact statistics on them, but I know that that there's full recognition by the U.S. Congress, who have passed laws saying that no prison-made products can be imported to the U.S. I believe that this is a corollary onto the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act of 1930, and this law hasn't been overturned at all. But even though that the U.S. doesn't allow for imports, it does export some of its prison-made products. And I believe that all the products that are made for private companies are only done at the state level, which is like the provincial level, not the federal level. All the federal level prisoners only do work that can be purchased, to produce things that can be purchased only by the federal government, which means that that's not a violation of international labor laws regarding forced labor, because it's only done for public purposes, not private.
Okay. So it's only state prisoners that are producing for export.
Producing for export, producing for private purposes, and for interstate commerce as well.
So what about what's the difference between the labor that prisoners are doing for private companies and for the state? Is there a difference in the conditions between those two?
Well, there's difference in conditions, and then there's difference in, like, you know, sort of conflicts of interest. Obviously, people who are convicted of crimes who are able to be, you know, punished by those who run the prison are very vulnerable as workers, because, you know, they don't really have appropriate means of redress. They don't have rights to collectively bargain. They don't have they don't have the ability to refuse work. And then their performance on the job can be used either to help them, you know, get a better ranking within the prison system, you know, which might help them get eligible for parole earlier, or if they're not, you know, well-behaved according to whoever's in charge, that can mean that they'll be in prison for longer. So there's clearly a private-public conflict of interest there. But in a public prison industry, the idea is that it's only for purchase by the federal government. So, you know, these workers who are in prison are only producing for public purchase, and therefore maybe there's less exploitative elements at work, and there's not this issue of competition, and there's not this issue of displacing non-incarcerated workers who might be looking for work in the sort of quote-unquote free market. And then there's also the issue of work and pay, and to what extent that any sort of profits can go into the maintenance of a prison. So I have right in front of me just some very rough numbers. According to the Criminal Justice Institution, who did a study of prison labor in 2000, those who work for state and federal production, they tend to make lower wages than those who work for the Prison Industries Enhancement Certification Program. They tend to work about the same amount of hours, but they also get wages garnished. So, but the major concern is to what extent exploitation is going on of a very vulnerable population for the purposes of making profit. And, you know, the federal prison industries and state prison industries aren't supposedly less, you know, vulnerable, because they're not seeking to make a profit, so they're not going to be getting any sort of private gain out of prison labor. Just to note, though, that those who work within industrial production, within privately held facilities, they tend to work the most hours, and they tend to get paid the less across the board. And we don't have really any statistics about the percentage of their wages that are garnished. But this number is a very small number, though, because the number of prisoners who are held in private facilities is not very significant. It's maybe like not even 20%. And of those, 9% is more accurate. And then of those, maybe 17% of them will work within a private sort of production facility.
You mentioned the lack of ability to say no to work by these prisoners. What do you know what happens to these prisoners if they refuse work?
Well, I guess in 1998, I believe, there was a strike in my home state of Minnesota. And I believe that this was not in a private facility, though. It was in a public facility. And they basically refused to work because they wanted to get paid minimum wage. And what ended up happening was that all the workers were segregated and put into solitary confinement until the efforts at work stoppages stopped and people were put back to work. If they refuse to work or if they complain, often they can be refused to have access to work, which can be, you know, a detrimental thing because the option is, you know, you sit in your cell all day or you can work. And so clearly they want to be able to have the opportunity to work, but it's just, you know, the idea of having any say in the terms and condition of work is not a possibility sometimes. Clearly workers in any situation are going to try to get together and talk about their conditions of work. But in 1977, the Supreme Court ruled in a case regarding North Carolina that states don't have to recognize the labor unions or associations of workers in prison. And so there's no legally recognized rights for them. And so this means that they're extremely vulnerable to sort of arbitrary disciplinary measures.
Why do you think the state did that?
There's a number of reasons as to why a state would refuse. Do you mean like why the state would refuse to recognize a union or why the Supreme Court would uphold such a decision or both?
I guess both.
Okay. I guess there's a number of reasons. I'm not a criminologist, although I'm very interested in what these sort of reasons are. But I think that in 1977, politically speaking, in the United States was sort of a point in which public sentiment and leadership and the business community was starting to turn against labor unions. And so the idea that prisoners who are, you know, citizens who have given up some of their rights because of their, you know, breaking of the law would want to have rights to at work, to have a claim in their positions of work would seem quite, I don't know, ridiculous to them, since the ability for workers who were not in prison to form labor unions was also being under attack politically at that time, and I would argue still. I think that that was also a time in which sort of law and order as a political platform in the United States was growing increasingly popular. That's sort of a period of time around when, right before Ronald Reagan won, and he was very popular for his, in California, for being very tough on crime. That's around the time when sort of minimum sentencing at the federal level for drug convictions was being abolished. And so I think that politically speaking, the rights of prisoners wasn't a very sympathetic issue. I think historically, the use of prison labor has sort of been a mixed bag. On some level, people think that it's an important thing to do, that those who are in prison should be like working. It's sort of a Protestant work ethic thing, like you'll labor as a sort of redemptive quality. So, you know, putting prisoners to work was sort of seen as a primary aspect of, rehabilitation, and therefore, you know, having prisoners to be able to come have redress or say in this situation was sort of seen as unnecessary, maybe even indulgent. And but there's a number of social theorists who argue that prison labor and prison in general is all about control and maintenance of control of lower classes, whether it be racialized or working classes, the unemployed, the very, very urban poor. And so, like, it would sort of fit into this general sort of approach towards, you know, prison being a place of control and not a place of rehabilitation or not a place of getting skills or being reintegrated into society.